This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, so we have Ravi Koparapu here with us today, and he's going to be with us here at Goddard in person for some time. Ravi got his PhD in astrophysics at the Louisiana State University. His dissertation was on gravity wave observations. But then during his postdoc at Penn State, he realized how awesome exoplanet science is and came into the light and started transitioning into doing exoplanet science with Jim Casting's group at Penn State. Since then, he's been working on the habitable zone, redefining it or recalculating it with an improved climate model. If you look up the Koparapu et al. Paper that he led, you'll see it's one of the most well-cited papers on the canonical habitable zone. And now that he's here, he's starting to transition to thinking more broadly beyond just that one box. And so he's going to talk a little bit today about the habitable zone and estimates of how many planets might be in the habitable zones of other stars. And then he's going to pivot and talk about what's next for this kind of work. So without further ado, Ravi Koparapu.
Thanks, Sean. So first off, I have only 25 slides, so you'll be going off to lunch quicker than you want. So
no, we won't.
We'll be going to lunch later than you thought, Ravi.
Okay, maybe I should have taken some time. This is another part of the work I was doing on and off based on the climate model habitable zone estimates that I was doing with Jim Casting at Penn State. And this is actually relevant to observers. So that's why I was really interested in doing this thing. I want to say right from the beginning that I'm going to talk about how common are potential Earth-like planets. I'm saying Earth-like here again. There is a reason for that. I'll come to that in a few seconds. These estimates, the estimates that I'm going to talk about are not mine. I'm going to just review the published literature values that are available publicly. And I do not prefer any of these ones, or I don't have any ill will against any of those estimates at all. So it's just a review of what does the literature say about the occurrence rate of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones of different kinds of stars. Okay, to do actually that, many of you have seen and probably have sick of watching already.
By the way, Ravi, mention for the folks online what page number.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is slide two. I'm going to slide two now. On slide two, you see the habitable zone estimates that Jim and I and several other collaborators, including Sean, have contributed to in redefining the habitable zones based on our updated climate model, the one-dimensional climate model. And what we have shown here again, please forgive me if you have seen this again and again, probably dream about this tonight. what we are showing here is the amount of starlight on the x-axis, instant on the planet, and the temperature of the star on the y-axis. There are a couple of things here. There are conservative estimates of the habitable zone. We'll not have to talk about it right now, and the most optimistic estimates of the habitable zones, and several of the confirmed planets, terrestrial planets, are also plotted in these parameter space, and you'll notice that there is Earth over about at 100% stellar flux, which means, you know, it should be, and there's Mars over there, and also Venus. And most of the other planets that you see here are from Kepler mission. These are the confirmed planets, Kepler planets. I'm hoping there is no Kepler 452b, I apologize, because that happened after we made this plot. There's one more planet that should be over here. But you'll see that there's one planet over here, at least 667cc, which was discovered by RV method. So that's the only confirmed planet that we know of right now, discovered with in the habitable zone with an RV with RV technique, terrestrial planet. Okay, so based on this data, what we would like to see, and also some other data which are standard candidates from Kepler mission, we want to see what is the occurrence rate of these terrestrial sized planets in the habitable zone, and it's called EDA Earth. The official definition that I've seen in the SDG report way back from 2007 from TPF SDG report was that the fraction of stars that have at least one Earth-sized planet, or Earth-like planet, in the habitable zone. So we don't know what Earth life is, but I'm going to use Earth science here because most of the data that we get is from transit service anyway, so why not just use it?
Out of curiosity, have people lately been starting to use it more like the mean number of stars per planet rather than the fraction of stars? I didn't realize that it was formally defined.
One is a fraction, the other is actually a number. And so it depends upon if you have observed, whether you have taken the survey of all stars and you divide it by the surveyed stars, you get a fraction. And if you're just interested in how many number of planets per star are there for.
Yeah. Are people still usually using fraction of stars when they give numbers for Aedes to birth?
I am proposing, and I use in any of the discussions I do, I use fraction of stars, but that's because you can represent that as a percentage, like, you know, 10% of stars in the galaxy have some kind of a planet and half or something like that. That gives you a percentage.
It's an interesting thing to have Chris look at it.
So I think
that's
we're using
impact
it.
Of it.
I just realized we might be using it wrongly, actually, in this case.
Well, different people use it. Different people publish it different ways.
Okay.
I had this discussion with Chris Stark.
Okay, good.
And I do not remember what we concluded, but I don't think it was a agreed conclusion. We'll talk.
We'll talk about it later.
We'll talk about it later.
Okay.
All right. This is again a quick thing that I want to point out. This particular aspect, especially for habitable zones around M stars, these results were based on one-dimensional climate models. But then now there are three-dimensional climate models.
Flight three.
Flight three here. You'll see a new study from University of Chicago where they've tried to estimate the energy of the habitable zone around M stars. Because planets around M stars are tidally locked, synchronously rotating or a synchronous rotation. So if you have a synchronously rotating planet around an M star, you would have the habitable zone much closer. This is again x-axis is stellar flux, the temperature of the star. The green line here is the inner habitable zone from our model, the 1D inner. And they say that if you use a 3D model and if you use if you assume a synchronously rotating planet, you can move the planet much closer to the star than what we get from the 1D model, which means the inner edge is a little bit closer. There are issues with this particular model, though, but qualitatively the result may be right. They assumed constant orbitality rates around M star, which is not true. If you are in a synchronous rotation, your orbital period and the rotational period are the same, so you should probably do a consistent estimate here. But that's a different thing. We'll talk about it later. But we verified with the 3D models that this result is more or less true, but maybe not as close as they claim. I'm talking about all these habitable zone estimates because it's very important to calculate the Aedes-Earth value. And then there is this another study from Sarasiga's group a year or so ago by Andra Zong, who was Sarah's postdoc at the time, where they said that they used a 1D model and said that, you know, if you have a planet with a very low relative humidity, a dry planet, you can move the planet, the inner edge of the habitable zone can be as close as 0.38 AU, that's the orbit of Mercury, and around a sun-like star. And they also propose that if you have some relative humidity, some water content in the atmosphere, the inner edge of the habitable zone can be about 0.5 AU. Remember, Venus is at 0.72 AU, and they are suggesting that if you have a sun-like star and you have very little water content in the atmosphere, you can move the planet to 0.5 AU, even further in than what Venus is located right now. But then Jim and I and a couple of us published a paper last year saying that, you know, if you actually want to do that, the lifetime of the lifetime of water on that planet would be very low. So even if you take an ocean's worth of planet water on a dry planet, it doesn't make any sense what's a dry planet and ocean's worth, but still, just dump an ocean's worth of water on a dry planet, it will evaporate in 400 years. So there is no stable water you can sustain at those distances using
could
this.
Could you say a couple words, though? What does she mean by a dry planet? What did she mean by a dry planet that's habitable? It sounds like a contradiction in terms.
No greenhouse
gases?
She means no water vapor in the atmosphere.
The atmosphere.
No, that's what they meant.
You have liquid water on the surface and not have any water vapor in the atmosphere.
That's the problem.
Okay, you can't.
Correct.
Okay.
Robbie says you're losing power here.
I got it. I got
but
it.
But what about
Robbie's being
dry?
Vena's right now is we think it's dry because it had a lot of it went through something called a runaway green.
So then it should also be habitable.
No,
like,
but it isn't. But for the same reason, these aren't.
Exactly
they lost
reason.
Its water.
No, for a different reason. It's,
no,
it's too hot.
Because and that's why it lost its water.
But they're saying if it's dry, it's not too hot, and I'm saying it is not too hot.
So okay, so once you lose your water, then a lot of other things can build up in the atmosphere. So once you lose your water, there's two problems to loss of water. One is that there's no water for the life. The second problem is that you don't have rainfall. And rainfall actually scrubs a lot of other things from the planetary atmosphere, including carbon dioxide. And as long as you retain volcanic activity, you can then build up a massive CO2 greenhouse, which is what Venus has. So even though Venus is dry, it still has a massive greenhouse because the lack of water has allowed CO2 to accumulate to multiple bars of atmosphere.
The reason why they say it's habitable, even with little amount of water over there, is because when you have a little amount of water, there is not enough greenhouse outgoing radiation. There is more outgoing radiation, infrared radiation, leaking out from the planet. So you are cooling the planet. So you can push the planet a little bit closer if you have little amount of water.
So they show that if you have a planet with a certain amount of CO2 in its atmosphere and no liquid water vapor, you can keep temperatures at the surface that would allow liquid water to be stable.
Okay.
However, if you had liquid water at the surface, the water would evaporate into the atmosphere, and that it's basically an inconsistent calculation that demonstrates a certain range of surface temperatures.
I'm not actually interested in the water at all. Fine, get rid of the water. Then Venus, what part of Venus?
So if you get rid of the water, again, it would be stable until you turned on the volcanoes, at which point the CO2 would accumulate until you went to a different
region. There was a short time where Venus was in
habitable.
Venus.
Yeah, that's right.
Was dry
yeah.
with a low CO2 atmospheric content. Then, over time, the CO2 built up. So they limited their CO2 way below Venus's CO2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you had a smaller planet without volcanic activity, it could still be, let's call it warm.
Possible.
Instead of habitable.
We're focusing way too much on a theoretical here.
I think actually the answer is that their model is not.
It's got to be important.
Model is not. I think actually their model doesn't sound either self-consistent, and even if it was, it's a very transient phenomenon.
It is not. I wish I had that.
But anyway. This isn't what the talk is about.
So, a quick answer, one sentence, that is there were a 3D model study with the dry planets, and they matched with our optimistic estimate, but I'm not with this.
Yes.
So, 3D models to self-consistent water cycles.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
All right. So, now jumping to the Earth values or the occurrence rate values, but the reason why I pointed out this particular study is because this has been used in calculating the occurrence rate of planets around the G-stars and GN-G-stars, which is what we are actually interested in. So, I'm going to come to that. All right.
Six, right?
Slide six. And so, the slide says the half stretch for southern extrasolar planets. I should probably mention this again and again. So, that's the slide I'm on. And it says on the bottom, the studies from Bonfi et al., the European group, they used half instrument to observe 102 M-dots was published 2 years ago. This is the only RV study that actually talked about and estimated the Eta Earth value or the occurrence rate value for terrestrial-sized planets in the habitable zone using the radial velocity technique. And they found that there were two planets in the habitable zone, Beta 667 CC, which we saw one, and Beta 581 D. And based on those two planets, they calculated the Eta Earth value around M-dots to be about 41%. Okay, that's probably fine. Probably. But then last year, a couple of my colleagues, when I was at Penn State, astronomers, they published a study saying that Beta 581 D doesn't exist because that's actually a stellar activity signal, and so probably none of the planets, except for Beta 581 C, if I remember correctly, Beta 581 D and Beta 581 G, another planet that was supposed to be in the habitable zone, don't exist. So now, in their calculation, out of the two planets, one is gone, and there is only one planet, so I don't know how to do statistics with one planet. So,
two is the...
Yeah, right. And so I can't calculate the Eta value for these for this sample. So from RV, there are no, as far as I know, no heat earth value estimates from for M dwarfs or even for GK dwarfs. All right. Now we are going to the Kepler mission. Corti Dressing and Descharnaux published a more recent estimate of their previous 2 years ago revised estimate of the heat earth value for around M dwarfs. And they now get about 16% using the habitable zone, conservative habitable zone, the narrower habitable zone one I showed you before. And they get 16% for earth size. When they say earth size, they mean 1 to 1.5 earth radii. And so that's fair.
And theirs is formally a number, not a percentage. It's planets per star. Not percentage of stars with certain planets.
So they get, so they in fact, this is a funny thing. When they initially published, they got an estimate of 6% when they put it on archive. And so I contacted them and said, you know, there were some issues with their thing, and then they revised it to 15%. But then I still thought that it was not right, so I published a paper in 2013 saying that, you know, you're underestimating your own data, but they used at that time Q1 to Q6, so I found it to be 48%. And then later on, after this, my paper was published, Eric Dyer from University of Hawaii published, using different analysis, tried to get a number for either for NDWARS, and he got about 47%. And so we were, at that time, all, you know, in the same ballpark. But now, Dressing and Charno have used all Kepler data from Q1 to Q6 quarters, and they get about 16%, which was originally what they had gotten before 2 years ago when they collected their estimates. So it's strange coincidence. Anyway, so probably now it looks like the heat earth value for NDWARS, at least from Kepler data, seems to be about 16% or so.
And this is, Sean said just now, let me just verify, this is planets per star.
Yes.
So what is the subtle difference between planets per star versus
stars? If you have multiple planets in the habitable zone, they would, one in one scenario, they would get counted, and the other they wouldn't.
So
yeah.
None of these analyses, they don't count multiple planets.
So this is Chris Stark.
Okay.
The planets per star is more important because most of the small planets tend to be in multiple systems.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure that it's a planets per star metric, otherwise you're underestimating it, really.
Yeah, I figured.
So if we look for with that last, right, the phase is going to be important. So you actually do have twice as good a chance of seeing it if there are two of them.
So to that question that I've read their papers, but I don't think they consider a second transit signal in their analysis to see if there's a multiple transit event. So this is based on one transit event that they can detect through their detection pipeline. Okay, so that's for NDWARS. Now, so they also have a couple of plots over there where they show, I'm showing this in terms of, this is the next slide after the Dressing and Charbonneau, and where they show planet occurrence. It's a blue color plot. This is the insolation, it's the amount of starlight on the planet, and that's the planet radius in terms of the Earth radius, so that's about one Earth radius, two Earth radius, and so on. And what this plot here shows, the occurrence rate in each bins of the radii and the insolation. I'm showing you the insolation because just to show you the habitable zone boundaries based on that, which is where we want to see on the heat earth value. What you will notice here is that this is black, which means this is a low occurrence rate. Anywhere you see white is high occurrence rate. And the black is probably astrophysical there. It's probably what nature gives us because we should be able to detect these planets. These are large, close-by planets, so still the occurrence rate is smaller, which means that that's probably how nature makes planets. And these here, you can see that within the habitable zone, between these two green dashed vertical lines, the occurrence rate between 1 to 1.5 Earth radii is white and compared to the remaining beams over here, which means that apparently these low, smaller size planets in longer orbit, because it's a lower insolation, are more common than the ones over here.
Does that say 41%?
Yeah, but that's based on the binning center binning. It's not just based on the number of planets in the in that particular bin. It's based on the completeness guarantee. But they also found that the planets per star log time period, but I'm showing here is the insulation, but they have another plot where they show in the log period the distribution of planet occurrence is about flat. So this is a consistently observed trend in various analysis from different people using different methods. So this seems to be a...
That seems to be one of the major conclusions of the Kepler mission is that distributions are constant in log period space.
Right. The occurrence rate is flat in the log period space, that's for sure. Okay. Now, so that's for the M-star that we talked about. Now, this kind of, we'll go and talk about the Earth-sized planets around, the Earth value around G and K stars. This is the Betti-Guerra et al. One, the most famous one that we have seen. Everybody knows they found an Eta Earth value of about 22% for G and K stars. And but the issue I had with this paper was that they used a flux estimate of 0.25 to 4. So what does that mean in terms of AU? 4 is, if you just use Sun as a proxy, then it's 1 over 4 squared. Square root of 4, rather, which is about 0.5 AU. So the inner relative halfdom for them is 0.5 AU, and the outer relative is about some 2 AU. So their inner relative half zone is 4 times much, or is much closer than what I would say that is the half zone inner relative. So here is a plot of that. Again, this is a stellar ring.
What page number?
Oh, this is...
We are now on slide 10, I believe.
Slide 10, which it says prevalence of Earth-sized planets orbiting Sun-like stars.
And you were just going, that's slide 9, and you were just about to go to slide 10.
Yes, I'm going to the next slide, where it shows a plot of stellar light intensity, which is, again, the stellar flux and the planet size in Earth radii. What they say, the green box here, shaded box here, shows the habitable zone that they used. Then they count how many planets are in their habitable zone, and they estimate the Eta Earth value. And they found their habitable zone is about 0.5 AU to 2 AU. That means Venus is also in the habitable zone for those ones. And there's one more important point. So when you consider G and K dwarfs, you cannot use a constant habitable zone because the habitable zone is a spectral type dependent. Depending upon the star, you need to change the habitable zone. So one size fits all doesn't probably work. Maybe for within a spectral subclass, but probably not across different spectral classes. And so when you use the conservative habitable zones or the habitable zones from our study there, you find that only 3 planets are there in the habitable zone, but none of them are not. Several of them are not because they receive too high stellar flux to be in the habitable zone. And so when you actually do that, in fact, they actually did that because they have a table in their paper. And they used several habitable zone values from several different studies. And I'm pointing out the one from our study because I'm bringing it up. Here it is. Using our value, they get it's 8.6%, not the 22%. Assuming if you the 22% is when you assume a 0.5 AU as the half zone. So the Eta Earth for solar-like star is probably close to about 10% or so from their study than the 22% at this point. But this was a particular data, a really good analysis actually, using their Eta Earth's own pipeline and derived their own completeness for this Kepler candidate. And that's what we get, Eta Earth for G and K stars.
Probably that's your conservative habitable zone.
That is my conservative habitable zone estimate. And the I did the calculation for the optimistic estimates, and you get probably about 14 to 15% or so within that robust. This number is interesting, actually, because I'll tell you why. The next slide, which says a statistical reconstruction of the planet population around Kepler solar type star. This was published recently by Ari Sulbert and Eric Guidos. And they have developed their own pipeline, again, did an independent analysis of all the Kepler data, and they found that the Eta Earth value is about 6.4% for GK stars, which is the same similar sample as Betti-Guerra et al. Data set too. And within the error bars, they both match with their two different pipelines and two different independent analysis. In fact, what they did was they compared Betti-Guerra's occurrence rate across the planetary radii with their estimates. So next slide, I'm moving to the next slide, where it shows the planet radius and the planet occurrence, and with the red line, the red dash dotted curve shows the Betelgeuse's planet occurrence rate, and the black solid one is from this Iris Hilbert's Erika-Jo study. They have a similar trend, but within the error bars, more or less at some places, there probably seems to be a matching. But the ones that we are interested in here are between 1 to 1.4 Earth radii. That's the terrestrial-sized planet. And within that limit and within the error bars, they have some overlap over there. So at the most, you will probably, I'm thinking that probably the Eta Earth value for GK starts with about 10% or so, because these two studies have, within the error bars, have obtained a similar value. So,
Robbie?
Yeah.
This is Chris. I spoke with Eric Pettigura about their finding at a AAS meeting a while back, and he claimed that they used the exact same catalog that he had produced. So while they do a different statistical treatment, they're actually analyzing the same population of planets. So I don't know that they actually have their own pipeline.
Well, did they use the same completeness corrections? I don't think so, because they have a different completeness curve here.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure of the difference, but Eric maintained that they used his catalog of planets that he found.
Which he actually is good, right? Because it's reproducibility with the same pipeline or with a similar catalog.
But not as good as if they had agreed with a different completeness.
No one did it, right? Oh, well, actually they did, because that's the one next slide, where this is the Foreman-Mackey paper that caused some concern. That's the exoplanet population inference, and they have done some, if I understand correctly, they have used a different distribution function for planet distribution across different orbital periods and log periods, and they did not constrain what kind of a distribution it would be. And it seems that they find the rate density of planets, that's the rate density of planets, is about 2%. So what does that mean? It means, so I looked through their paper a little bit more detail. So they define a quantity called, I think it's capital gamma.
This is now slide 15.
Slide 15, sorry. Slide 15 is the only equation of this whole talk. They define that gamma Earth as the rate density of the planets, exoplanets around a sun-like star, evaluated as the period and the radius of the Earth. So at 1 Earth radii and 1 Earth orbital period. Okay. So if you define that, that's the rate density, so you have to integrate it over the radii and period to get actually a rate, occurrence rate for these planets. The reason why they define is in the equation 20, that's the equation 20 up there, they say that they use that symbol instead of the eta is because in terms of measurable, because they can define these in terms of measurable quantity with no mention of habitability or composition. But eta Earth is not based on the definition that I understand, the fraction of stars that have one planet in the habitable zone. So if they mean that the habitable zone is habitability quantity, then probably maybe that's the reason they had. But I would still say that they should probably consider using. In fact, this gamma Earth would be the subset of the eta Earth because it is at orbital period of the Earth with 1 Earth radius. In fact, they did that. So they integrated this over the rate density over the different radiant orbital period with some limits on the habitable zone, and they still get about 2%, and that's probably what they quote in the paper, and they compared that with the Eric Pettigura's estimate. I think they, after you integrate it over the radiant orbital period, they say that if you do the similar analysis for Pettigura et al., you get about 5%. And I have no comeback to this paper because this is the only one that is not agreeing with either Eric Pettigura's or with Iris Hilbert's estimates. And these are the only three papers that I've seen that actually calculates about GAK star eta Earth values. Out of the three papers
that are published.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That are published, and out of these three, two agree to more or less to within an error bar, but one is completely different by an order of magnitude. they get 2% either, and Pettigura et al. Get 22%, but the correct error rate is about 10%, so it's like a factor of 5 or so.
And we really don't know why this is so discrepant.
I did not understand what they.
So in Daniel Foreman Mackey's paper, when he fits the planet occurrence rates, he claims that there is a downward trend in the planet occurrence rate as a function of period at long periods that is real. And I believe in Eric Pettigura's paper, Eric claimed that that downward trend was likely due to, whatever, bad statistics, incompleteness or whatever. But Daniel fits that with his MCMC analysis or whatever, and for whatever statistical reason claims that that downward trend is real, and that's what reduces it by factor 5.
And by long periods, they mean things approaching the longest period that Kepler can see, which are on the around a year.
Frankly, if I would have to bet, I would say Eric's probably right on that one if I would have to bet money on it.
So I if once the talk is done, I have Eric's paper. I will show where, Daniel says that, you can see in Eric Pettigura's distribution function where you see the log period versus the planet occurrence, you can see a dip at the towards the longer period range where you will see a fall off of the curve. And Daniel says, Chris pointed out exactly the same thing, that that's a real thing, but Eric says that, you can actually, he covers and says that it's a flat distribution. It's an argument whether you want it, so maybe that's why they get, but I can't imagine that there will be a...
But W first will help with this once it launches.
Microlensing, yeah.
The microlensing will get longer, will start at that long period.
The longer periods
for what we have so far will be short periods for W first.
Yeah.
You'll have to wait 10 years.
I'll show you, if I have time, I'll show you that plot and we'll talk about that.
This is good news for the W first people, though. It gives them another argument for...
Short. I mean, they're going to have a hard time getting in less closer than 2AU.
No, so they'll do the outside.
Right.
The
point is
that
the
intersection point.
Yeah. I mean, you might not solve whether or not there's a valley, but you'll at least know whether or not the ground is level on the two sides of that valley.
Interpolation versus extrapolation.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Precisely. Yeah.
Okay. So the next slide is a paper by Chris Burke, and they also... an analysis of Kepler quarter 16 up to Kepler quarter 16 data, and they come up with a number, but then the definition of a planet occurrence is a little bit different for them, where they say that they define a quantity called theta 1.0. What is that 1.0? It means the number of planets here. This is defined as the number of planets per star within 20% of the radius of the planet and orbit of the Earth. And so if you assume that beta 1 as definition, then they get a beta 1 value of 10% within the error bars, and can be allowed within the range of 0.01 to 2, which means anywhere between 1% and 200%.
So you're saying that 10% RP there, you're using the RP of Earth, so 1?
So within the 20% of the RP, it's not exactly RP. Within the plus or minus 20% of RP,
so
with at Earth distance.
So their bounds are radii from 0.8 to 1.2, and orbital...
At 1 year.
And orbital periods from 300 days to 420 days.
Well, no, they are from period of the Earth.
Right, but within 20%, right? So it goes from
within 20%.
So it goes from 300 to 420 days in the orbital period.
Gamma definition is a little more arbitrary.
Right.
Just to pick 20% is a little arbitrary.
Well, maybe
no, it's not.
I think within that's a measurable value within the Kepler data that you can determine the radius of a planet. I think maybe that's why they chose that one. But that zeta 1 is actually a subset of the eta Earth because it can encompass any. But this is not a wrong thing or anything. They are focused on G stars, so maybe that's why they defined it in terms of the zeta 1. In fact, they do say that for G dwarf modes, so they are mostly interested in the G type star. So within that error bar, I would say, Sean said, what is it,
300 to 420 days.
So even if you change the spectral G subspectral classes by about G 3 to G4 or something, you would still fall probably hand-wavingly within the habitable zone and within the planet sizes, and so I have to...
You'll have an inaccurate habit of...
Why did they do this? Why did they do this weird, define this in a strange way?
Chris, do you have any...
I think it's simpler for observers to not have to get involved with deciding which of the theoretical habitable
zones
is quote unquote the right one.
Yeah, but if you want to do that, the right way of handling it is what Daniel Foreman-Mackey did, not this.
So they explicitly state in this paper that this is not their final official Eta Earth estimate. So they're being coy, and my guess is they're choosing to speak in terms of measurable quantities to avoid
it. They didn't want to scoop themselves for later.
Yeah.
That's why they did it. Okay, I got
that's,
it.
That's probably true.
I can't say about it, but I think I have...
Because this is the Kepler team, a lot of it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think this is reasonable if you are just using only the G stars, right, G dwarfs, so it should be...
In some ways, it's the most honest number if you look at their error bars. Right.
All right, whatever.
Oh, fish.
Whatever.
So how does the solar system fit in this? Is it like 5 sigma range or 1 sigma range? Because let's say for the solar system, you have 200% or even 300%. So this
range includes like all sorts of different types of extrapolations, I believe. So when they say an allowed range, I believe they're talking about... They may be talking about a 1 sigma uncertainty, you know, wildly dependent upon how you extrapolate.
And for our solar system, actually, the number here would be 1 or 100%, because by these bounds, neither Venus nor Mars have orbital periods within 20% of the Earth's orbital period. They would both fall outside these bounds.
For radius for Mars.
But Well, the radius...
And the radius is also smaller
than
Mars. Mars actually falls off... On both axes.
We say there are two planets in the habitable zone within our solar system, but if you use the Kepler or some other...
This, according to this definition, there's one in our... The zeta number for our solar system is one.
Well, by definition.
Yeah.
That's what they do. Yeah. Okay. Ah, so this is a slide I stole from Natalie's talk that she gave a year ago or... 6 months ago on the NIA seminar, the preliminary estimates of what they think are, this is public level, so it will show the Eta Earth value for G, K, and M stars in the error bar.
Someone calling another number?
Welcome to Verizon Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1, switch 18-5-4. Welcome to Verizon Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1, switch 18-5-4.
Yeah, okay, it usually only does it twice. I have no idea what it is. It usually only does it twice
right.
or thrice. And then
okay.
All right. Thank you. So this is for G stars, it's about 36%. K stars, about 10%. 25% for M stars. But the weighted mean apparently is about 15% for G, K, and M together. This is within the error bar. They more or less agree, all three of them.
This is for the Venus to Mars habitable zone, right?
No, this is the conservative habitable zone here. So I'm on the slide where it says small, less than 2 or 3 planets in the habitable zone. So that's the conservative habitable zone. This is the optimistic habitable zone, the most widest you can expect. And these are the Kepler planet candidates on top, the blue ones. Some of the confirmed ones are also here.
I believe Natalie told me that the numbers themselves are for the optimistic habitable zone.
Oh.
Yes, the numbers are for the optimistic.
Optimistic?
Yeah.
So you mean that this is even lower?
For conservative. Yeah.
We should compare apples and apples then.
What do you think we're trying to say?
That's what the SAG's going to do. Well, actually, that brings you to your next slide. Right? So we're now on slide 18.
Which is the Exoplanet Exploration Program Analysis Group, led by the marvelous leaders, Russ Belkow and Chris Stark. Really, it's a service to the community in trying to make sense of all these studies that have been published on getting different estimates, different definitions, different radii, different hazard zone values, and they are trying, these monumental tasks, to get everyone together and try to get a consistent definitions, estimates, and values so that we can get an occurrence rate that is not confusing and that's useful, actually, to data accumulation missions. So we have a SAG next week.
Thursday.
Tomorrow. So we'll be discussing more on this one. Okay. So that's great, but I want to lead on to this particular topic, but because there is something I'm going to talk about in the next slide. The test mission will be coming up in the next 2 years and would probably potentially give some targets for JWST. This is the next slide where it says test on that slide. Since the ecliptic poles have the full coverage for test, which is also a continuous viewing zone for JWST, you have a great opportunity there at that point to observe these test target stars. But what happens, next slide, this is a plot of the same habitable zone in terms of the orbital periods, not in terms of the insulation and the temperature. And the blue shaded region is the optimistic the conservative habitable zone, the red one is the optimistic one. And what I'm showing here is the contours of radial velocity sensitivity for an Earth-sized planet at different distances. And you see, and also I plotted some tests. Values, test detection limit based on the all-sky survey or the ecliptic poles. And if you have an all-sky survey, at the most, test would be detecting about 10-day orbital periods because there would be, you know, assuming there are two transit events, if we are lucky. If you start at the month, then you'll have three, but I'm not lucky. So, anyway, in the field, though, at the most, you would be getting probably about 15 or 13-day orbital period planets. But at the ecliptic poles, you'll probably get about 170-day orbital period planets. But then you'll have also less targets at the ecliptic poles because of the smaller of coverage. Right.
Robbie, do you know
yes.
how many M stars or mid-K to mid-M stars are actually within that pole, those continuous viewing zones?
Ah, I hope you nobody would ask that question.
This is good.
So, not many is the answer. There is a plot in the George Ricker's paper. Not the George Ricker's paper. There's a new paper, actually, from the test team, where they actually did their analysis. Sullivan's paper, right, sorry. Where they actually did this a estimate of how many planets they can detect with their with tests. I can't give you a number, but they were... this is the wrong talk. I have another talk where I had a slide where it shows it. So I can probably show or bring it up once my talk is done. It's less. It's not much. Even though JWST has a continuous viewing zone at the ecliptic poles, just because if there are less number of, and they're faint, and so you would have less number of M dwarfs compared to other ones. Right. Okay. The reason why I brought this up is because to lead to our other paper, where we calculate with Stephen King, Sean Goldman here, where we calculate the occurrence rate of Venus-like planets, Venus analogs, around M and GK dwarfs. For M stars, that apparently the Eta Earth or the Eta Venus value is about 32%, but G and K dwarfs is about 45%. Most of these planets, so either for TESS or even for JWST, we would be more sensitive to these planets that are close by. So we would be more sensitive to Venus-like type planets, whether they are in the runaway greenhouse or not probably habitable, but they are terrestrial, than these Earth-sized planets. So that's why we would be starting over here, and so this would be a useful quantity to see what would they look like and what are the estimates of this Eta Venus one. Now, how did
they really like that? What JWST will mostly see is clouds.
So this is the question I was going to have with you and Natasha over there. So because they have asked several people that if you want to find a Venus-sized planet or super Venus, for example, around the M star with JWST, what is the observable signature that you want to look at?
CO2 and the mid-infrared, that's it, but there's nothing else.
Well, we have to get over the perception that clouds are fundamentally uninteresting, because we're going to see a lot of them, and we have to think about how clouds and aerosols are actually going to be informative of physical processes ongoing on these planets.
And there are spectral features of clouds.
There are spectral features of clouds. Yes. It's been a problem in part because of the wavelength range that we've had. Clouds tend to have very flat features, but when the wavelength range expands from what we've been able to do from Hubble and ground-based observations, clouds might get a little more interesting.
Okay, we should have a talk about that.
Yeah, we definitely need to.
Okay.
Because I can show you a little thing where we can. Okay. I don't know about Venus-type clouds, but we certainly look into it.
There's pretty, serious clouds there. Well, haze, actually, I guess. Is it clouds or haze?
Well, you've got to find that.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's another problem entirely.
Condensates are...
They're clouds.
They're
down
clouds.
Below, they're haze.
Both. Okay.
Part we can't see is haze.
Okay.
The clouds block you from seeing haze.
Okay.
I really would love to have that discussion, because those are the planets that we would be first detecting or would be capable of observing those ones. And the reason why we chose, how do we define that Venus-like planets? We have this is a figure we remade from Kevin Donnelly and Dave Catling's paper, Cosmic Shoreline.
So the first thing is the outer edge of the Venus zone is the inner edge of the habitable zone. So then the question is, where is the inner edge of the Venus zone?
Thank you, Sean.
Sorry,
Robin. It's a slide that shows a plot of escape velocity and effective stellar flux is where I am on now. Basically, essentially what this plot is saying that there is a limit where you can push the planet closer to the star before its atmosphere is eroded, and also there's a limit where the habitable planet can be into a runaway greenhouse. So essentially, those two limits will form a Venus zone kind of planet. And on this plot, though, that's the escape velocity of the gas and the stellar light on the planet. This curve, anything to the line here, anything to the left is airless body, which probably they don't have. The atmosphere, the ones here on the right have some atmosphere. These are all Kepler planet candidates, the blue circles. You see the Venus and Earth over here. This particular dotted line, the cross, the air of dotted line, shows what happens if you push Venus to the point where it's receiving about 10 or 20 times most stellar flux and how much stellar flux it would take for Venus to lose its atmosphere. So that's the point. Now, how many are there, such kind of thing? So this is, again, a habitable zone there, but in terms of Venus zone. So these are all potential Venus candidates, Jake.
Does that previous slide assume something about composition? Or is it really any molecule?
These are all calculated based on whatever the atmosphere composition is.
This work started with an observation of sort of what Kevin Donnelly called the cosmic shoreline, which is a dividing point in solar system objects between airless bodies and those with, let's call them tropopauses, because even airless bodies have tenuous atmospheres. And then that led to them working on this theoretically for a while. And when we talk about escape to space, it's composition relevant because they're talking about hydrogen. And so, I shouldn't say that. It's composition relevant because they think they're giving enough energy to escape just about anything.
Well, it's hydrogen escape. Diffusion is escape, right? Could be any hydrogen compound, methane, ammonia, hydrogen molecule, anything.
But on a log plot, once you get past the hydrogen limit, you'll get past the other limits relatively quickly.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so that includes the composition of Venus.
If you want to make it at the airless body.
They're part of the right. They're retaining everything.
Okay. The next slide where, again, it shows multicolor plots. These are the potential Venus analog candidates from Kepler data. Compare that with the habitable zone candidates I've shown, or the confirmed plants I've shown before. There are numerous of them here. This is just saying that, you'd find more Venus zone planets when you actually go with TAPS or JWST. So that's why it brings interest in knowing what would you do. What would you see as an observable signature if you want to observe this with JWST? Because these are the first Venus zone planets, Venus-like planets that we'd be able to detect. Okay. So this is going to be my the last but one slide. This plot was made by Sean Goldman here. Again, stellar insulation. where Jupiter-sized planets at different distances, Saturn-sized planets, Neptune-sized planets, and so on. These are Earth, and these are terrestrial sites, and so on. Yes?
What is an installation? Not instead of insolation. What does that mean?
Star.
What are the units?
One means that it's the same amount of the flux that Earth is receiving. So
it's the intensity?
That's the amount of, that's the solar constant value.
An earth scientist word.
Well, to be very literal, the insulation on all these planets is zero.
Well, we can't say insulation, right? It's solar.
Yeah.
That's why it's insulation.
Right. Because they're getting no energy.
Starlight.
Starlight.
Light incident on the planet.
Got it. Got it.
That's why we call it.
So if the planet is bigger, then the insulation is bigger.
No.
Is that right?
No,
it's just flux. Valley, it's just flux. It's incident flux. So it's
Earth per second per centimeter squared.
It's 1360 watts per meter squared. Is
okay.
One.
Okay.
10 times is 13,000.
It
might help
to
say insulation versus insulation.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. That's why you're okay. So that's your
Earth
insulation here. And this is installation there.
Yeah.
So this is 10 times 1360, this is 100 times 1360.
Yeah.
The planet
okay.
is okay. All right. So we made up some random boundaries for these, what should be a Jupiter size. So we define a Jupiter size anywhere from 4 to 1000 Earth radii. Don't ask us to justify that. This is just an initial thing that we wanted to start with. We'll argue about the sizes later on. And what our goal was to see, okay, we know what is the eta Venus value, the occurrence of Venus. We kind of know what eta Earth is. So what are the occurrences of these Jupiter-sized planets at different distances? So I used Pedicura et al. Data set, again, their own analysis, their own data set, their own completeness correction. And I get for this, if you just fix these boxes for Jupiter-sized planets at different installations.
So that'd be hot Jupiters.
Well, not exactly, because this is also included. So if you
note the boxes, the larger boxes for the Neptune class and the gas giants, what we're trying to do there is we're trying to put the dividing line instead of being on habitability metrics, which are frankly irrelevant for like the Jupiter-sized bodies. The next most dominant process to affect our future observations is going to be whether the chemistry of the atmosphere is dominated by equilibrium chemistry or by photochemical processes. And so we actually had like a half-hour debate in my office. There were just three of us, so there's clearly more people that can contribute to this conversation than the three of us. But we went around and around and around, and at the end we just said, you know what, we don't really have a good number on that right now. We're just going to put that dividing line at one Earth orbit, because we know at one Earth orbit, photochemistry is going to be important. We're actually going to do some calculations to refine that boundary, but it is a placeholder for the dividing line between hot, what we call hot Jupiters, which are photochemically dominated atmospheres, versus cold Jupiters, which we think of as equilibrium chemistry dominated atmospheres. And then we have the same thing for the Neptune or the sub-Neptune class worlds that have hydrogen envelopes, but are not exclusively, or whose composition is not, bulk composition is not dominated by hydrogen.
Yeah, so essentially the plot says that it can be done. So you can calculate
right.
what is the occurrence.
Right.
So I don't have estimates yet on the Neptune and Uranus all year.
You could view this as ambitions to kick off a series of 10 more papers by other groups that twiddle with these boundaries and get different eta numbers.
Yeah.
But.
So
I would prefer it if people would publish, you know, slopes
yeah.
rather than, you know, single values anyway.
Distribution.
Yeah.
Rather than defining specific boundaries, just, you know, a function of planet occurrence as a function of radius.
Yeah.
Isn't it what the Pedicura and other
yeah.
people did that distribution?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's disagreeing with creating boxes like this rather than...
Oh!
Yeah.
That's
sort
both
of
I think both are useful, but for different purposes, personally.
But
well,
do,
always,
you,
yeah.
do you want to know this number? I mean, like, how... I haven't seen a paper that showed that, you know, these within these boxes or within these estimates of radii, these are the occurrence of these Jupiter.
Yeah, no, we talked about this. Nobody bothered. They put vast amounts of effort into Eta Sibiris and put very almost nigh on zero effort into calculating the planet occurrence rates for any other kind of planet where they actually have data. So this is useful, super, super useful.
That's why I'm
yeah.
saying that it can be done. It's
yeah.
not difficult. I did it.
Yeah.
The people who actually
and you've only been here for 3 days.
No, super, super useful. useful, definitely.
Yep.
Hey, Robbie, I have to get going, but I wanted to point out I just spoke with Natalie on Monday, and
yeah.
she said that there's a new version. There's a new version of the Kepler pipeline that she's really excited about. Apparently, it removes a lot of the systematic noise, and the light curves look a whole lot cleaner. And I asked her about whether her estimate of 15% plus or minus 5% would change. And she, you know, she didn't want to say, of course, but she basically said that she could imagine that it could change by up to a factor of 2, but not any more than she said she couldn't imagine that it would change by more than a factor of 2.
So 30%.
Or
7.
Okay.
Oh.
Hey, that's better than, you know, 1 to 200%.
Well, the question is, do the error bars also go up by a factor of 2?
They will.
Hopefully they'll go down.
No, they'll go down, probably.
I would assume that the uncertainty is going to come down, too, which will be nice.
Did she give an idea as to when the pipeline's going to be up and chugging and we'll get that?
Right. So she said next summer, I believe, is when they're shooting to have their official occurrence rates finished.
Oh, okay.
Summer. Yes. Yeah. Keep watching my announcements for our ATLAS seminar.
Yeah.
So look at this 15%, and given that 10% of all stars here above Jupiter is 3-day orbit, so does it mean that between 3 and 300 days, there are only 5% of Jupiter?
I can't scale it like that because... Well, I can probably because these are complete, right? These samples between any. These are big enough to be detectable by now already.
So Jupiter, they came from somewhere. So does it mean that 10% of them made it and 5% did not make it to be a Jupiter?
Well, this is a complete sample. So maybe your estimate of that 5% is probably decent enough. I can do a quick thing and see if that is. That's the case, but I cannot imagine why you cannot do that.
I'm just asking.
No, I'm saying, I'm talking out loud, that these are complete samples. You should be able to detect them, so
yeah,
maybe...
What those black boxes you showed earlier that was like 0.01%? Remember?
Black boxes.
There was a grid with black boxes in the upper.
Oh, that was
white and blue box.
That was the Kepler analysis that Natalie did, I think, where there was the
dressing.
Oh, the dressing.
Yeah, but one. Yeah.
So
that's just page number.
Oh, this is slide number thing.
It's the one with the planet occurrence grid in the top left and. Planets per star versus insulation on the bottom right.
Bunch of blue boxes.
Yeah, so that is slide number 8.
There you go.
Trying to compare that to your other plot now.
So, okay, so the super high insulation values here where you go black, those are the ones that we would say are consistent with airless bodies that have had their atmosphere stripped because of the intense amount of radiation they're receiving. So you can imagine receiving a certain amount of insulation that would cause Earth to enter a runaway greenhouse regime. You can imagine even more radiation that would strip away the atmosphere entirely. And that's where I think that. So that's around 300, Ravi. Where are we on the later plot? Which is here at 300 is on the later plot.
Okay, So you want to go to that plot?
Right, but you are above 4.
So
yes,
from 2 to 4,
and go
that went up to 15%. So somehow you went
Go to your other slide, Robbie. So from 200 to 400 insulation and from 2 to 4 Earth radii is the black zone, right?
That's because you need to count on all of these estimates, right? Because it's including up to 1 Earth insulation. Right? It's not just that.
Right.
That's 15%. The whole thing. 15%.
Go forward one more, Rodney.
I thought the question was which fraction of those are hot Jupiters and which are
warm
Jupiters.
So Jeremy,
it sounds like
Jeremy, the part of the plus that was blocked would be this little box right here. It would be from here over in the pink box.
They don't have anything.
It's from 1 to 4 Earth radii and 200 to 400. For insulations or insulations worth of energy.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Well, so now I want to. That number was essentially zero.
Yeah.
than looking above it, and you get up to
50%. There is a difference. So they are M dwarfs, and this is GK dwarfs.
Those, okay.
And,
so,
and we don't know what a
giant.
They don't plot what it is. They don't plot what it is above that. Also.
Well, M dwarfs, correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like M dwarfs don't have many Jupiter-sized planets around them. So.
Okay.
So
maybe that's
the one
the big
with the different spectral class.
So the RV is still at 10% of all solar five stars here for Jupiter.
Yeah, but we don't have an RV estimate here, right?
So, but we could.
I mean, with the complete sample with the hard Jupiter from RV, we could, but there's no estimate of those planets, hard Jupiter planets of occurrence. It's just not there. Vasan, does that answer your question? More or less? Yeah, well, let's talk about it.
I mean, right now, we're putting this up there as a dartboard for people to
you
know, throw things at, and we'll refine over time.
This is the first cut. Any questions?
Is that it, Robbie?
Yeah, that's about it. I'm not going to talk to you.
Any questions for folks online? Any other questions from folks here? Excellent. Let's thank our speaker. Hit Star 93.